Well, thank you, Alan, and thank you all for being here on this very chilly New Orleans November morning. Can't say I was expecting this. Most of the time it's warm. But anyway, what I really want to very briefly do is go over the program that NIH, and especially NIHS, has related to work in the Gulf also, but where that has led us. Because, in fact, what we've done, what we have done and are doing and will continue to do in the Gulf really has turned into a stepping off point for a whole new effort in how we do research in a disaster situation and trying to help facilitate those efforts. So the NIH has lots of funded work right now going on related to the Gulf. It's kind of a four-part effort here involving all parts of NIEHS as well as a bunch of our sister institutes and centers. So I'm going to talk about all of these parts briefly, but the Gulf study is the large prospective longitudinal study that we started we were in the field within 9 months of the Gulf oil spill, which, guys, is way too late if you want to get anything related to acute effects, but boy, was it fast compared to doing and developing a traditional epidemiology study, and that involves over 32,000 workers, and workers is a not your typical occupational cohort. This could involve housewives, this could involve college students, this involves fishermen, and so on. The worker training program, which you can see on a little just picture of it on your right, we were actually embedded in incident command within 9 days of the oil spill, and it was work that was done by our grantees and our people running that program that actually trained the 147,000 people who had some level of training to clean up on the Gulf. We provided a great deal of the information to do that. The National Toxicology Program, within 2 weeks, had a literature search and information up on the website available for people to try to understand what were the chemicals that were in the Gulf, what do we know about them, led to lots of questions about what we didn't know about the different chemicals, never mind what happens to them once they get weathered, or in the case of the oil, what happens once it burns. But that was up very, very quickly, and I'll tell you about the work we're continuing to do there. And then our extramural research consortium that was formed with, involves 8 NIH institutes and centers, and this is truly a consortium approach with 4 Gulf Coast universities and about 45 different community groups. And Bernie, if you want to talk about resilience, the involvement of these community groups in studying their own health and in developing approaches to their own health, that's what builds resilience in a community. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. So the Gulf study is a prospective longitudinal study of over 32,000 adults involved in the oil spill cleanup. Now, Dr. Collins announced on June 15th at a House hearing that he was going to give NIEHS $10 million to conduct such a study. Believe me, $10 million is a drop in the bucket when you start this longitudinal kind of study. So far, we've put close to $70 million and are planning to spend that amount in order to do this study. I'm going to make the point now, and I'm going to make it again. We're creating platforms that other investigators will be able to work with, to collaborate with us, because you can't start today to try to understand what happened in the Gulf almost 5 years ago now. It's an ongoing issue. But anyhow, this study was envisioned. We collected first of all, I should say, this is an extremely difficult study to do, to try to recruit thousands and thousands of workers, many of whom are transient, many of whom don't have cell phones. It's a young group. It's about 20% female. Has been a real challenge. You know, we originally were aiming for a cohort of about 50,000. But of the over 32,000, I should say, our outreach was not only in English, but in Spanish and Vietnamese. We actually have a small sub-cohort of 1,000 Vietnamese fishermen who have been involved. But the rest is primarily Hispanic and largely, actually, Caucasian and African-American. We did the initial interviews from March of 11. Actually, we started a little bit earlier than that for the baseline interviews. And then we actually went into the homes of over 11,000 workers and collected a clinical assessment and biospecimen collection. We worked very closely, for example, with the local public health departments, so that if we, for example, came in contact with people who needed immediate medical attention, whether for a physical or an emotional reason, we could hook them up with appropriate caregivers at the time. Now, our intention is to follow this cohort for at least 10 years, and we are planning to do repeated telephone interviews every 2 to 3 years, but in a subgroup, we are actually doing biomedical specimen collections. We are also we've been partnering with SAMHSA to increase our ability to do behavioral assessments and look at the whole issue, the major issue of psychosocial stress in this population, to look at resiliency. And we are planning to link to all the different kind of medical registries that exist. The clinical exam, again, has started several months ago, and we are recruiting from the group who we did the initial in-home clinical assessment. We are planning to recruit 4,000 people from Alabama and Louisiana. So far, we're doing quite well with this. The people who we can find are very eager to participate. And we're intending to do more than one clinical assessment, assuming that we have the funding to do that. So the preliminary findings. Well, I gave you a very brief overview of the demographics, but we are finding that people who were involved in the cleanup are more likely to report wheeze, cough, and other respiratory symptoms 2 years after the oil spill than those who did not work on the cleanup. And we're really doing a great deal of work, not only trying to develop an industrial hygiene kind of job exposure matrix, but we are trying to validate that matrix with the limited number of samples of either some biospecimens that we have and actual measurements that we have for environmental exposures. I'll give you just a little preview there that it looks like our industrial hygiene matrix is, let's say the actual measurements that we have are doing a good job of saying our industrial hygiene matrix is pretty good. So that the people that we identified as more likely to be highly exposed, in fact, are those who are highly exposed and so on. So that's encouraging. In addition to the respiratory symptoms that persisted and were there at least 2 years after, and as I said, we're back doing a second round of questionnaires, we are also finding that there are clear evidence of psychosocial stress in this population, that the workers are scoring higher on the standardized scales for depression and post-traumatic stress symptoms than the non-workers. And one of the key questions here is, well, how much is because they were exposed to oil, and how much is it that the oil spill experience is what has caused their problems? And these are not easy issues to tease out that we're working on. Now, the academic community group program that I mentioned, which is the Deepwater Horizon Consortium, and I should mention that the Gulf study, which is an intramural study, is actually embedded as part of the consortium here. This is a 5-year, $25.2 million program, which involves much of NIH. Our partners are Tulane, LSU, University of Florida, and the University of Texas Medical Branch. But as I said, we've got about 45 community groups who are integrally involved in this from the very get-go, even from the conceptualization of those studies and the design. These are different populations than the worker populations. They tend to focus on workers and children. We did part of the recruitment involved women who were pregnant several years after the oil spill because these studies didn't get started. They were funded at the end of 2011. There's enrichment for cultural and ethnic minorities here. And a big question for many, many people in the Gulf has been the issue of seafood safety and whether the seafood, in fact, is safe to eat. The group has worked together so that it's not one group proceeding on its own. They get together on at least a yearly, if not more often, basis and look at issues of seafood and resiliency, look at the issues of their populations and community outreach and dissemination. So I don't think we have to read through all the findings that we have here, but the good news is that it looks like that the seafood, at least today, within the past year or so, is quite safe. There is essentially almost no evidence of the petrogenic PAHs that were generated by the oil spill at really even being detectable in any of the seafood. That doesn't mean, and I don't want to say that we know that the ecosystem has returned to normal. But as far as eating the seafood doesn't appear to be a problem. There's a lot of work still ongoing to try to characterize the metabolic profiles of some of the PAHs. You know, we know a lot about a very few PAHs, but there are at least 70 or more different polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that we have to understand more their effects. We're continuing to look at the economic issues, which in fact appear to drive some of the mental health issues. A lot of work being done on resilience and so on. Okay, keep them going, Alan. So, again, there are a lot more publications that have come out of this. I think this is just to show you when you have a focused effort that involves a lot of committed people working together, the communities with the academics, a great deal of information can come out of it. But I think among some of the real issue that we're seeing again and again and again is the psychosocial impact of the Gulf oil spill on the communities and trying to work to understand what it is that makes the community resilient. Now, I mentioned our worker education and training program. This is part of our Superfund effort. And as I said, we joined the Unified Command very quickly and produced guides, which you can see at your bottom right hand. That's in English, but we also had these little pocket guides, which were very handy for people who were doing cleanup just to know what they were doing in English, Spanish, and Vietnamese. And working with SAMHSA, we're developing additional training to improve resilience through mental health awareness. And this is really for our hazardous waste cleanup and emergency response workers. I mean, believe me, they can suffer from PTSD and social stress just as well as the community members as well. So I mentioned the NTP response. What we've actually done, we got samples of the oil. We did a complete chemical analysis of the source oil and the sediment to better understand the exposure. We've developed many analytical chemistry measurements and approaches, which will be very useful for future assessment of complex environmental samples. And we're trying to understand what priorities should we use to which pHs to study. We've put over 70 pHs into our rapid high-throughput screening approaches to try to identify which are really the bad actors here, which ones do we need to conduct additional studies on. So we're using some mid-throughput kinds of approaches, using C. elegans, using zebrafish, other kind of models that we can use to understand what the hazard might be. And we're looking at a whole diversity of different human cell lines to understand what do we see in what genes are turned on or turned off in exposure to some of these. And I should say, many of these studies involve complex mixtures, not just individual compounds. So some of the key needs and opportunities that we have learned from the efforts that we've been done is that when you do develop these cohorts, use them as a platform for future human health and toxicology research. Not everybody needs to start their own cohort. Come, partner, work together, and build on what we've had. We can look at issues of health and vulnerability and resilience. We are developing with the samples that we took from the 11,000 workers, but the 4,000 workers were doing the intensive biomedical analysis of. We're looking to develop biomarkers and create repositories. I think Bernie mentioned the need for that. And we have to establish baselines of different communities. And for that, we need to just go in and have biobanking of, for example, placentas and breast milk and cord blood and other samples so that we have something that we can refer to. We've got to look at resiliency and vulnerability, both of the individual and the community. Both are actually very important, and we have to understand what are the metrics to use here and develop biomarkers, for example, of resilience and interventions when there is lack of resilience. So we also have to do a better job of characterizing exposure. We're doing a good job now. We have the methods to kind of identify the chemical profiles of different crude oils. We really need to understand what happens when they get weathered, what happens as they pass through the environment, what comes out of a well is not what people end up being exposed to. We have to look at chemical mixtures, and I said NTP is approaching that from stuff. And we really have to know what's the background level, and we do have a small nested study within this that basically is finding that people in the Gulf, in general, do not appear to have elevated levels compared to age-matched and ethnically matched people from the NHANES sampling of the American population. That's good news for people living in the Gulf. So we have a lot of tox research related to creating standards and so on, but we're also looking, Bernie, here's the word, epigenetic effects of the crude oil and contaminants in some of the different model systems that I talked about. So there are a lot of opportunities for improving communication and education here. We have to leverage, continue to build on the community engagement that we have in our different program areas. We have to work on building environmental health literacy. Actually, I should say not only environmental health literacy in the communities, but science literacy in general. The average state of science literacy in the American population is abysmally low, but we really need to work, especially in the Gulf area, with our children and with different NGO groups and different healthcare workers and officials and so on. We have to enhance the community understanding and the capacity for evaluating the impact and evaluate effectiveness of training materials for target populations. So what has come out of all what we've done in the Gulf? Well, a whole new disaster research response, we call a DR2 project, which based upon the ongoing lessons we got, not only from the oil spill, but if we can go to what happened with H1N1, where we needed research on medications, but you couldn't get it done quick enough because there were issues related to the IRBs. With Hurricane Sandy, it took 11 months to fund extramural efforts to try to respond to that natural tragedy. In an article that was published by Francis Collins and Tony Frieden and Nikki Lurie and others, Nikki is the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, they stressed that there's a need for generating knowledge from what happens in a disaster so that you can be better prepared to deal with what will happen in future, both natural and other caused disasters. So we started a pilot project just over a year ago to galvanize and accelerate needed infrastructure as part of a larger departmental effort. Dr. Aubrey Miller is providing the leadership for that effort, and he's here if anyone wants more information about it. But this is a cross-NIH effort, but it also involves, as I said, other parts, not only the department, but, for example, EPA, USGS, and so on. The objectives are to develop a central repository of data collection tools and research protocols. We have a website that the National Library of Medicine has established called Disaster Research Response, and there are all kinds of protocols, about 160 different ones, on that website that you can just pull down, and they're basically ready to go. We're working very hard to get them basically pre-approved by NIH IRB and by OMB so that they could be rapidly used. We're trying to develop what do you need to do if you want to do rapid data collection and what are the kinds of samples you need. We are trying to establish training opportunities, tox support, and environmental data that to go with the human health. So we have this repository, as I mentioned, of data collection tools on the National Library of Medicine website. You can have metadata here. They're pre-reviewed, and we're hopeful that they are going to be useful to researchers regardless if there's a federal response or not. There could be a state response. There could just be a local response, but it's a place where people can go in and when you have an emergency situation, what do I need to do? What kind of samples do I need to collect? What do we know about those kinds of samples? So, again, there are more than 160 tools currently available. We're working at improving the training for research responders. As I said, they suffer from issues of resiliency and stress as well, but we're training them on some of the protocols and the websites and so on, and really alerting everyone to some of the health and safety issues. We actually held our first training exercise using some of these tools last April at the Port of Los Angeles, where we brought together over 140 people from the state, from the local communities, public, you know, NGO groups, people who are involved from the industries in the area at the Port of LA. And I hate to tell you that at least my evaluation raised lots of issues of concern. Is if there was a tsunami, which was the scenario that we set up, that hit the Port of LA and Long Beach, lots of people would never escape. It was actually very sobering, but it identified things that now you can do something about. Now, in fact, the local communities in the state are saying, we need to identify some escape routes, for example. So it was very helpful. So we are working on developing a environmental health network for research response and disasters. This involves government at all levels, federal, state, and local. It involves our academic partners as well as our community partners. because again, as I often say, you cannot do environmental health work without community involvement from the very beginning. We're working with our partners to identify important research priorities, to continue to develop and prioritize the disaster research response tools and website and training materials. We are holding forums to evaluate and improve research response and developing a network of trained environmental health science researchers who can assist in disaster responses without interfering with the disaster response, but gather information which will allow us to understand what the effects may be and be able to avoid them in the future. In fact, the first test of this group's reach and ability was held with, we sponsored an IOM workshop 2 weeks ago in Washington related to the Ebola response, you know, because there's very little known about if you have contaminated surfaces, how long do they propose a potential health danger to people, for example? How do you get rid of the waste from the Ebola, from people who are ill with Ebola? So we tried to bring this all together so that we can learn for future potentially hemorrhagic disease. So we have timely community-based collaborative research that involves our public agencies, our academic partners, and we're beginning to use citizen science as well as our community groups. So thank you all.
No problem. Thank you, Linda.